Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the films The Lost City, X, Halo, The Spine of Night, and More Than Robots. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Don't Forget the Driver. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The big news for this week is the Oscars, and people have been writing think pieces and remunerations over and over and over again about what they think's going to win. And you get this every year. Everybody comes out with these bold predictions, and nobody goes back and looks at what messes these predictions were. And I do that, too. I mean, I go out there almost every year. I say there's going to be a split between Best Director and Best Film, but I always go out for some pretty long shots just because if you predict it, you're going to look like a genius. So I'm going to take these predictions on where the wind's blowing. Now, I'm not going to read through all the nominees because you're talking about dozens of films and names I'm going to be throwing at you. I'm just going to talk about I call them the big six. Well, I'm calling them the big seven because I got a seventh category I want to point out. But the big six, meaning best picture, best director, actor, actress, best supporting actor and actress. And so let's start off with best actor. I think that Will Smith's going to win. I think the wind's completely blowing in his direction. Well, I mean, I thought he did a good job in the role. It wasn't my favorite performance. Personally, I would give it to Benedict Cumberbatch for The Power of the Dog. You know, but, you know, he's been trying to win an Oscar for so long, and this one looks like he might actually get his shot here. Now, in the best actress category, there's a bunch of them out there, but I really think it's going to be Jessica Chastain who's going to win for The Eyes of Tammy Faye, mainly because she's been picking up not all, but a good number of big wins. Personally, I would have chose Olivia Colman for The Lost Daughter, but that's partly because I just adore Olivia Colman, and I think she's fantastic in everything she does. Now, going to the supporting roles, and for Best Supporting Actor, I think Troy Kotsur is going to win for Coda. He's, again, been cleaning up a lot of stuff, and while there's always good actors out there in the list, I really think that his is a strong enough performance, and I think he does a great job. I personally love Kieran Hines in Belfast, but it was a very small, subtle, not as memorable performance as Kotsur's role in Coda. Now, when it comes to Best Supporting Actress, I think this is the one that I think is probably the most sure, and that's going to be Ariana DeBose, who was in West Side Story, and I'd agree with that one. I actually wouldn't change that one. I think she absolutely deserves the Oscar for this. She did a great job, and I really think this is going to be the little bit of love that West Side Story is going to get from the Oscars and the Academy this year. Now, before we talk about the Best Picture, I do want to throw out my seventh award category, and that's Best Animated Picture. Now, I have always been a huge fan of animation, and anybody who's listened to the show knows how much I adore animated films. And a lot of people are setting their sights on Encanto because that would give Lin-Manuel Miranda his EGOT. I don't think that's going to happen because I think the Mitchells vs. the Machines from Netflix is going to win, mainly because if you look at all other major awards, I mean, it hasn't won every single thing it's ever been nominated for, but in terms of the major awards given out, it's won every single one. It's gone on top of Encanto. And even though there's been a sort of a rise in interest in Encanto, I think there's just a lot of love for the Mitchells versus the Machines. So I think that's going to take away Best Animated Picture. Now, Best Director, Best Picture, I'm going to talk about that as one, because usually I predict a split. Because again, it would make me look like a genius if I can predict that. But this year, I don't think it's going to. I think it's both going to go to The Power of the Dog. Now, I love Belfast, and I think I probably would put Belfast on top of each one of those. But that's just me, my own personal choice. But I think that The Power of the Dog is the best shot that Netflix has had in years to win a Best Picture Oscar. A lot of people are wanting to talk about Coda winning. And I know that there's a lot of love for Coda now. Where were you guys last summer when it came out? I don't know. But there's a lot of love for Coda, and there's a lot of momentum Coda is getting. I just don't think that momentum is coming as heavily in, especially the older category of the Academy. The Academy, you got to remember, the Academy is not your average Twitter user. It's an older group, and CODA is kind of out of the box. It's a little bit too pop, a little bit too, you know, WB, I think you could say. And even though there's a lot of people, and they're talking about, I've seen some analysis of how they're going to be doing the ranked voting, because some people are putting Power of the Dog way down to the bottom of the list. But I think there's going to be enough, like, number one choices for Power of the Dog to win that. And let's forget about that whole little kerfuffle with what Jane Campion said a couple weeks ago at the Critics' Choice Awards, because I think that's kind of blown over. And plus, she came out and did Damage Control the very next day. I don't think that's not affecting anybody, and not in terms of any sort of big voting irregularity. So I really think that at least the front runner seems to be the Power of the Dog. And CODA would be an upset, but I don't think we're going to get a Moonlight situation with this one. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about, I actually covered it a couple weeks ago. It's a movie called Men, and it's directed by Alex Garland, who did movies like Ex Machina, and he did Annihilation. It's a new thriller, and it's coming out May 20th. But they dropped a new trailer that gives you a little bit more to know what's going on in it.
You're tormented.
It feels more like...
haunted.
Yeah. Something happened. My husband went upstairs to our balcony and let himself go.
You must wonder why you drove him to it.
Why? I didn't drive him to it. A man followed me out of the woods.
This looks interesting. It looks surreal enough that it's going to work as a horror movie. I just hope it's not overly heavy-handed in the messaging. Because when a messaging for something like this, I mean, even with the name Men, and it's about a woman who feels that she's being pushed upon by men and that everybody's putting hers in fault, and she's taking the brunt of the anger and aggression from men. And that just is just so obvious from the beginning. I just hope it doesn't hammer it away so hard that it's like last week with Master, which has some interesting ideas, but it was so unsubtle with its messaging. The next one I want to talk about is Mystery Science Theater 3000's getting a season 13, but it's going to be online on the Gizmoplex starting on May 6th.
Hold on to your butts.
Oh, we got movie stars!
Mystery Science Theater 3000 is coming back again.
Movie in the hole.
This season, MST3K features 13 brand new episodes. The new season isn't on television or Netflix. It's available exclusively on a brand new platform called the Gizmoplex, built just for MST3K.
A bright and shining beacon to the worst that cinema has to offer.
It all starts May 6th, so reserve your season pass now.
There's a 13th season of Mystery Science Theater 3000. Netflix had canceled the revival of it, and I'm not exactly sure what's going on behind the scenes, but they decided to basically open their own streaming channel for Mystery Science Theater, which is a neat idea. The problem is it's about 5 years too late. They should have been doing this 5 years ago and gotten a jump on it. At this point, so many people have their money spread so thin around all the different streaming channels, and they're so behind the curve on this that you'd have to make up for lost time. I mean, look at how much platforms like Peacock and even Paramount Plus, to a degree, are just struggling to make up for the time that they lost by not capitalizing on this 3 or 4 years earlier. So I think it's going to be interesting to see whether this works. I think it's a great concept to deliver directly to the audience. I think RiffTrax has a better platform for it. And the problem that they might face is that there's enough RiffTrax stuff out there in old classic MST episodes that it's not going to be worth the, what, like $135 for the premium package. You know, you're talking about putting up a pretty penny for the whole shebang at the beginning. But we'll see. I might dip my toe in that water. I love Mystery Science Theater, but there's so many other options out there for riffing. Its uniqueness has gotten diluted. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Spine of Night and More Than Robots. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's start off with the movie reviews and talk about The Spine of Night. In a fantasy world past, different leaders try to control a magical flower that gives people immense powers.
There are so many things that man cannot know. The bloom is the last light of the gods.
The sacred bloom traveled, and my dreams traveled with it.
It is unspeakable power. Whatever you dream, you will have.
This is available exclusively on the Shudder streaming service, so if you want another service to sign up for, you got Shudder. I've talked about Shudder quite a bit in the past. It's meant for genre more edgier, R-rated, adult-oriented, but scary, usually has some sort of horror bent to it. And I enjoy Shudder. I like Shudder. I'm a big fan of it, mainly because it consolidates horror movies, and you always get something different to watch there. But it's got a huge collection of horror-based programming. And The Spine of Night, it's an animated film, and it's very heady because it takes place over three different, I guess, eras. And this is not on Earth. I don't think it's sort of like a different world, sort of like how Middle Earth is a different realm than where we live now, for the Hobbit movies. But in this one, there's this like tribal group that worships this flower that gives them power. And when people get control of it, they can use that power to cause some pretty horrible things. And they can become a good ruler, and they can provide for their people, but they can also become a tyrant. And that's what ends up happening. And it tells it in three separate eras. The first is very, almost Dark Ages level. And then the next era is more Renaissance, and then even beyond it into some technology. And, it's really heady, and it's out there, and it's adult. It's grown up stuff. This is not something you want to watch with a kid because it is violent. There's not really a lot of sex or swearing necessarily, but there's quite a bit of nudity. I mean, animated nudity, but it is violent. I mean, ultra violent. You have battle sequences and eviscerations and beheadings and all that kind of stuff. And so it's a very graphic animated film. But it's animated for grown-up animation. And it reminds me, it's not a style that you're used to seeing now. I mean, it's not like a Family Guy style of animation, but it's also not like a cartoony kind of style of animation. It reminds me of the kind of stuff you would have seen like in the 70s and 80s, stuff that from something from like Ralph Bakshi, who did the original animated Lord of the Rings, or when he did Wizards. I'm not talking about Fritz the Cat. That was too cartoony. I'm talking about like the more grown-up level, putting something in animation form because there's no way you could do the special effects. Or something like the early Studio Ghibli stuff, like the Valley of Nausicaa, or Heavy Metal. Heavy Metal's another one. Or something like the Aeon Flux cartoon that was on Adult Swim back in the 90s, I think. It was the 90s when that finally, maybe late 80s. But this is it's an interesting series. I mean, it throws a lot at you, and it's really out of the box and is bizarre. But I gotta say, it is a neat movie, and it's worth seeing. It's different. It's different than anything else you're going to see out there, and usually that's something that piques my interest at the very least. So I'm going to have to say The Spine of Night totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is More Than Robots. This actually came out last week on Disney Plus. I was watching it, and I thought it was something that was worth giving a highlight to. Disney and Lucasfilm sponsored the first competition, a challenge for school teams around the globe to build the best robot.
We created FIRST to inspire kids to be a microcosm of the real world of engineering.
6 weeks is barely enough time to build a robot.
When we started this with 20-some-odd teams, now we have thousands and thousands all around the world.
It is way more than a club. Teaches you the skills of life.
It is More Than Robots.
This is a documentary, and it's directed by Jillian Jacobs, who is best known for playing Britta on Community. So she's known as an actress, but she's finding her way into directing, which a lot of people do. A lot of actors, not just actresses, but you know, it's not uncommon. I'll be watching, like, I was watching an episode of Picard the other day, and Leah Thompson, you know, Caroline in the City, Marty McFly's mom, was directing it. And I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. You know, so you start seeing a lot of these people who spent time in front of the camera try and do stuff behind the camera, and that goes back for years. But it's neat to see, you know, a lot of women are starting to show up in the marketplace as well. And this movie is focusing on the positive aspect of STEM. Stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And there's a big push. And I got kids who are school age. Well, my two oldest have graduated, but I still got another one in school. My wife's a teacher. So I hear a lot about STEM. There's a lot of attempts to get people, especially non-traditional people, into STEM, a lot of outreach to females and people of different demographics, you know, getting everybody involved in this stuff who has an interest in it. And you know, back when I was a kid, a lot of those people were just marginalized as nerds. We didn't like you. But, you know, these are the people who are going to be building the future. So it's a very good-natured and good-hearted look at STEM and robot competitions. Now, most people think of robot competitions, and even if you watch the show Space Force, which is on Netflix, they have a whole section where they go into the BattleBots type frame. And what I like about this is that's not the kind of competition it is. This is a competition that does rely on cooperation. And yes, you are in competition with each other, but you also form alliances. And the entirety of this competition is not designed on who can destroy the other one better. That's a very Luddite view. I mean, yeah, it makes fun TV, but I always felt that that sort of betrays what the purpose of robotics is. Robotics are supposed to help people, and that's what this thing does. And it shows people from all different walks of life. It shows kids from Japan. You've got kids from Mexico City. People all over the globe who are working to build these robots, and the robots have very specific things they have to do. And it's a great look at cooperation, and I don't even know if this was Jacob's point, but to me, an underlying message that kind of drove through this is the use of cooperation and working together and having a good purpose for this. It's put together in such a way that the people in charge, the mentors, the adults that are at the head of this thing, their attitude sets the stage. And if you go in there and you're like, we want to win and we're going to crush the opponents, I mean, okay, fine. You're going to do that on the football field. That's good. But I think that not everything needs to be a crush the competition. I mean, it's interesting to see how they went behind the scenes to make sure that while there's winners and losers, they are forced to work together and find ways to build an alliance. Because honestly, that's how science works. Science does not work in a vacuum. And I took a lot of respect for this one. Now, it tells a story of going into the competition that, you know, as you're heading into the pandemic. So it does get derailed at a certain point, but it has an uplifting message and it's a good point. And I think if it encourages anybody to get involved in STEM, that's good, because we need more people out there trying to make the world a better place rather than people just trying to destroy each other's robots on a battlefield. So I'm going to have to say More Than Robots kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Lost City and Halo. To Feckeyes at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about The Lost City. A romance author is kidnapped to help find a lost treasure, and her cover model takes it upon himself to rescue her.
Miss Sage, I enjoyed your book about the Lost City, and I believe you're the one who can help me find its treasure.
I have to respectfully decline.
I'm afraid I must insist.
Loretta Sage is missing.
I'm gonna rescue her. I just want her to think of me as more than a cover model.
Let's start living dangerously.
Alan, what are you doing here?
We're here to save you. I'm certified CPR. I'm certified CrossFit. I have snacks.
Off to them!
This is such a mixed bag of a movie. On the very surface, it's a remake of Romancing the Stone. If you remember Romancing the Stone, that was a movie, 1984, I think. It starred Kathleen Turner as a romance author who heads to Colombia to try and help her sister who's been kidnapped, and she ends up with a sort of jungle man played by Michael Douglas, and they're on their way to try and find, they have this treasure map to find this stone, and the two of them fall in love in the process. And that's a great little movie. I remember it came out before Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came out. And I remember hearing, I think it was Siskel or Ebert saying that it's a good enough thing that it'll do while we wait for the next Indiana Jones movie. And this one's essentially a remake of that because Sandra Bullock plays this very reclusive sit-at-home author. But I mean, apparently she has a past, or like her husband had died, and she's still mourning over that years later. And the two of them used to do anthropological research. So she has a little bit of knowledge, but she still is somebody who likes to just sit in her bathtub and drink wine. And when she's kidnapped by Harry Potter to go do this, her cover model, who's basically Channing Tatum playing a modern version of Fabio. I mean, Fabio, a lot of people don't even remember who Fabio was. I mean, certainly not the younger generation. Fabio was this romance cover model, and they always put a different face on him, but his body, he had a very good body, and he posed for a whole bunch of romance covers. And then eventually he became so famous for doing that, and he got his own covers, and he started writing his own books in the sense that he put his name on it after somebody else wrote them. And he did, like, movies and stuff. It was a whole thing in the 90s. The 90s were weird. But Channing Tatum basically plays a version of Fabio. And he goes out, and it's this fish-out-of-water thing. And we're always in for a good jungle adventure movie. You know, you had one last year with Jungle Cruise. But usually when you do something like that, you have one of the characters be completely inept and the other one very good at the job of going through the jungle but not dealing with humans and other people. And that's what you had with Romancing the Stone. But in this one, both of them are completely inept with being in the jungle. So the story gets in the way of itself. I mean, usually you have somebody who's good at what they're doing and can go through the jungle while they're helping the other one just try and stay alive. But it's kind of both of them figuring out. So it's weirdly positioned. And it's strangely both over and underwritten. There are bits in this movie that it feels like they workshopped over and over and over again, and they are going for jokes, because in essence, it's a romantic comedy. And they're going for jokes, and they'll have a big buildup, but then they just give up, and they're like, we don't have a punchline, so let's just cut to the next scene. So there's a lot of those that just don't land. So it's not a perfect movie. It's got all these weird wrinkles and warts throughout it. But here's the thing. Channing Tatum and Sandra Bullock are both very good at what they do in playing their stock characters. I mean, this is not Sandra Bullock trying to play Unforgivable, that one on Netflix where she's out of prison and it's this dramatic role. No, this is her just, this is going back to the stuff that made her a whole lot of money with stuff like Miss Congeniality and Forces of Nature. And she's great in a role like this. I don't care that she's pushing 60. I mean, she's bona fide AARP age at this point. But she still looks great, and she still does a good job in this. And she holds her own against Channing Tatum. And Channing Tatum's very funny in this as well. He plays affable very well. And the only thing that saves this movie is the chemistry between the two of them and their on-screen likability. Because there's so many points in this movie that just the movie's threatening to completely disintegrate and fall apart, but the only thing that keeps you watching is you like the people in it, and that kind of works. So, you know, I thought it was cute. It's a nice throwaway date night movie. Don't think too much about it. It's one of those that if it does well and they do a sequel, that sequel's going to be terrible. But this one just, it's the kind of movie you go into and you end up liking regardless of the flaws that it has. So it's an entertaining little film. It's worth seeing, you know, if you're looking for a date night. So I'll say The Lost City kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Halo. In a future war, a super soldier goes rogue after interacting with an alien artifact.
Covenant forces appear to be excavating some kind of object.
When I touched the object, I felt different.
What they did to us makes you numb.
And you just decided to help me. Why wouldn't a Spartan do that?
What does one do with a superhuman you're not sure you can trust?
Find the Halo.
win the war.
This is on Paramount Plus. It's a weekly TV series, and they dropped the first episode this past week on Thursday, and there's a new episode every Thursday. I've not seen anything in advance, so I'm going on what you guys have seen. But I have a confession to make. I just want to point out here, I have no skin in this game because I have never played Halo in my life. The only thing I know about Halo is it's a guy in a suit of armor. I've seen, I guess, pictures of it, but I've never even seen gameplay. I don't play much video games. I'm aware that Halo exists, and I'm aware that they have been developing this as a movie or TV project for at least a decade. I remember at one point, Christopher Nolan was attached to it, Steven Spielberg was attached to it, and he actually executive produces the series. So I am coming to this completely cold. So they could change everything, and I'm not going to know. Here's the thing, though. The cinematic landscape is riddled with terrible video game adaptations. Now, some of them are just misfires from the beginning to end, something like Super Mario Brothers from the 90s. But even when they try to make a version of the game, it comes across really either weird or clunky or it doesn't quite work. You know, when they did Doom back in like 2005 and they did, you know, Assassin's Creed, the only one that really kind of worked is maybe Mortal Kombat a little bit, but you can get to a story to that. And maybe Resident Evil, although it certainly starts to circle the drain after they get through a couple episodes of that movie series. The reason that video games don't make good movies is because video games are very open-ended and premise-based. They basically set up a backstory and then drop you in there to do whatever. Whether if it's a first-person shooter, you have to kill a bunch of people and get to an exit. You know, beat a boss, get out of the location. It provides you a path to get to the action that you then completely control. And it's not character-based. They may have a backstory, and they have these great ideas for backstories, but it all is just set up for the game, and the gameplay itself is very open-ended. Whereas movies need to be plot-driven, for the most part. They need to be plot-driven in stories and characters, and they have a definite direction they need to go. And as I watched the first episode of Halo, I'm like, okay, it looks cool. It's this neat sort of sci-fi space western. And in some ways, it feels like one of those Amazon TV series where it's just nothing but set up for like 3 or 4 or 10 episodes. I hope it gets to a plot soon. But I mean, you see him, you know, the main character, Chief Wiggum, who then has to be in charge of the girl, and they're trying to get this artifact and figure out what's about it. So I can see the setup, but the setup, it is a little bit clunky for framing a story around it. And I just want to make sure that there's enough characters and humanity in the story to make it interesting. And I mean, yeah, it looks cool. And I'm sure that the gameplay, it takes a lot of that from there. But I have no skin in the game. So if they've done a bad adaptation of it, it's not my fault. And I don't care. So, but at least this one, it looks promising. I'll probably watch for another couple weeks. It might be terrible. Who knows? It just, will this thing gel into an ongoing story? So I'm going to hold out hope, and I'm going to say, at least at this point, episode one kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about X and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Don't Forget the Drive. Back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the film reviews and talk about X. In 1979, a small adult film crew rents a property on a Texas farm only to face a violent attack.
And my wife, Pearl, is next door, so I would appreciate a little discretion. I just moved in.
He don't know what we're doing, does he?
It's better to beg for forgiveness and ask for permission.
I want to be in the movie.
Well, you can't.
The story can't just change midway through.
My wife is not well. It happens after dark.
This is the new movie by Ty West. And fans of horror should know who Ty West is. He did movies like The Innkeepers, The House of the Devil. He did this first sequel to Cabin Fever. I don't hold that against him. But he's been involved in that group of the people who do stuff like You're Next and in sort of that generation of filmmakers. And he's sort of this new breed of horror movie filmmaking that came out in the new millennium, we'll say. And he's a fantastic horror movie director, and he's wickedly smart about horror movies. So you have to know that going in. You know, as he's working on these movies, that he's not just imitating a lot of, you know, it's a lot of the things he does are very specific. He's a very good filmmaker. And I was very excited to see this one. I didn't get a screening of it early, and I decided to cover it for this week coming up. And I'm glad I did, because I'm a huge fan of Ty West's work. I think he does some really neat stuff, and it's innovative, but also very throwback in nature. This is evidenced by the fact that this movie takes place in 1979. And there's a great love for 1970s road features, especially something that takes place in Texas. Not for a small reason, because of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But this is more than just a homage to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. This is a compendium of horror films from the 70s and early 80s, all kind of rolled into one. And I had a blast watching it, because it references, just visually, it references stuff like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Evil Dead and, you know, even certain things like The Town That Dreaded Sundown, some of these other movies that had this, you know, almost this rural, scary feel to it. And it really feels like it was actually made in the 70s as well. And, you know, just the story of it, it's already, you already know it's edgy, because it's about them making an adult film. So they have this crew that goes to this Texas farmhouse, and they're like doing it for the production value of the background. So they rented it for like $100 or something like that. And they're making this adult movie, but they don't tell them that they're making an adult movie, but there's something creepy going on behind the scenes. And, you know, you know it's going to happen, because it to the point that there's a scene, like right as the movie opens, it's a flashback movie. So the movie opens and you kind of see the aftermath. And then you just want to know how they get to that point. And it gets very grisly and bizarre and twisted. And it's definitely R-rated. You know, you got like Brittany Snow, who's best known for like the Pitch Perfect movies. She plays as one of the actresses. And yes, if you're a Brittany Snow fan, you're probably going to want to see this movie. But she does a great job as the starlet who's getting ready to go out of her prime, but still wants to make it big in Hollywood. You have Mia Goth as another one of the actresses, but she sort of has that doughy-eyed Dirk Diggler sort of, I'm going to be a star, but this is my way of becoming a star look to her. And it's very edgy at that time. And it also feels real. I mean, there's parts of it that don't quite edit together properly, if you know anything about the filmmaking part, but at least they're trying. They're not like, sometimes you see movies about filmmaking and it's amazing because they're literally on a set and they're not shooting the scene about making a movie in any sort of realistic fashion. But this one certainly does work that way. And it's uncomfortable at times, but boy, is it, you know, it's a gut punch, but not in a depressing, horrible gut punch sort of way. It's like when things happen, you're just like, oh my God, wow, that was powerful. That was, I knew something was going to happen. And, whoop, yeah, you really got me. So, I mean, it's not a, you know, like I mentioned Texas Chainsaw, it's just more for the setting and the feel and that 16mm look of the film, that mid the late 70s tint to it, which really that sells it to me. And you know, Rob Zombie's been trying to do this for years when all the movies he's made, but this one nails it, and it doesn't go completely nihilistic the way a Rob Zombie movie is. So I had a lot of fun watching X. It's definitely R-rated. I don't think it's X-rated. I don't think it's NC-17. But it's definitely R-rated, but it's worth seeing, especially for the horror movie fan. So I'm going to have to say X totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I was going to cover this movie. It was called The Signal Movie, and it's about a Japanese TV series. And I'll just let you know that the Blu-ray's out there. I think it came out last week. I was going to cover it, but the entire thing's in Japanese. And then look, I understand I'm capable of reading subtitles, but the cover box said that it had an English dub to it, which annoyed me because it didn't. It didn't have it on the DVD or the Blu-ray. And my thing is, it's very hard to cover anything in a foreign language on the radio. And so I kind of avoid that, unless it's something that's so massively popular. But even then, I never covered Drive My Car, which is up for an Oscar in a couple categories. But anyway, so I ended up swerving and taking a turn. So if you're into The Signal, which was an old procedural TV series in Japan that they did a follow-up movie to, outside of that, I decided to go into my BritBox account, and I like to pull up stuff that I've just been watching, that I found interesting, that I think are worth highlighting, even if it's not something for everybody. And this one is a little bit niche, but it's pretty good. It's called Don't Forget the Driver. A coach driver in Britain discovers a stowaway in his luggage compartment and tries to find a way to hide her from his family and the traffickers who are after her.
Dad, who's the woman in the front room?
I met her.
On Tinder.
Don't be ridiculous. Plowman's. You stay here. Here.
You don't have to put on an accent. She's not stupid.
I am looking for my brother.
She's in terrible trouble. I'm being hounded by human traffickers. I'm in a bit of a pickle.
So what are you going to do about it?
This stars Toby Jones, who is one of my favorite actors. I think he is brilliant. He doesn't get the recognition in America that he gets in Britain. I mean, most people recognize him. He's Dr. whatever his name, one of the guys in Hydra from the Captain America movies, and he was put into the computer in Captain America and the Winter Soldier. He shows up in a ton of things. He played Truman Capote in Infamous, which was the Truman Capote movie that didn't win any Oscars. Which starred Sandra Bullock, by the way. He's such a great actor, and he does some really interesting stuff in terms of television in Britain, because the way television's structured in Britain, they do like these 6-episode runs, and they're very short series, and it allows some bigger names to do various TV series and several per year. He did a whole series called The Detectorists, which used to be on Netflix. Now you can find it on Tubi. But that's a neat little bit. It's about people, they're metal detector enthusiasts. But he does a great job. He helps write the stories, and he's just brilliant. He has these stories that are full of pathos. So in this story, he's this single dad. His wife has left him, and he's got a daughter. She's kind of trying to figure out her life, and he's trying to make ends meet. He drives this coach. So it's basically he's a bus driver, a private tour operator. And, you know, he'll take people to different places, like they go to like a donkey museum, and they, you know, sometimes they go across the channel to go into France or something like that, because, you know, you're in England, you can get there pretty quickly. And so he's got a rather mundane job, and he's just trying to get his life together and keep things going. But this woman just kind of falls into his lap, and he doesn't want to leave her at the hands of these human traffickers, because he doesn't know what they're going to do with her. And she's just looking for her brother, and she's fleeing a war-torn country, and it's a really interesting look at sort of like the immigration question from a totally different perspective. It's very easy to dismiss immigration stories that take place in America because we're a little bit close to it and we can be very opinionated about it. But the stuff that's going on, the immigration issues that like England has or other places in Europe are very different. And so you have a removed nature when you watch these things that you can look at them a little differently. And I think that that's a very eye-opening way of looking at things and realizing that it's not just America. It's not just people on our southern border that are complaining about this. It's a problem all over the place, because anywhere that has a lifestyle or problems that puts it lower than another place, they're going to want to emigrate to those better places. And it's a sweet story. It's only about 6 or 7 episodes long, but it ties all these different characters together, and it's rather quite lovely. So Don't Forget the Driver. It's on BritBox. It's worth checking out. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Also available this week, we have Nightmare Alley available on 4K, The Godfather Collection on 4K, and the series Dexter: A New Blood. And that's it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Morbius and Moon Knight. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.